The story is told, though who can say if it be true, of a clan of medieval warriors awoken in modern-day Manhattan, of the animated series that told their story.
It is an age of darkness. Superstition and the sword rule. It is an age of fear. It is the age of gargoyles.
Welcome to Voices from the Eerie, a Gargoyles podcast.
Welcome back, Gargoyles fans, to another episode of Voices from the Eerie, a Gargoyles podcast. I'm your co-host, Greg Wyshansky, and joining me as usual is my co-host and partner in crime, Jennifer Ellian.
That's me. Hello.
Hello. And also, Jennifer is not in camera today. Her webcam is currently experiencing technical difficulties, but we hope she gets it fixed soon.
Fingers crossed.
This is for our Patreon viewers who are watching the video version. And join us as usual as the co-creator and supervising producer of Gargoyles, Mr. Greg Wiseman.
Hi, my webcam's working perfectly, so I just apologize.
So is mine. I apologize too. The pretty one's not on cam tonight. All right, so we're here to discuss Heritage, the second world tour episode, and it takes place off the west coast of Canada and deals with the Haida people. And over the years, this episode has garnered a little bit of controversy. As we've discussed in email prior, they did a lot of research and they were on point with the Vikings, but they were not quite as on point here. And Gargoyles always had a reputation of being progressive. Some people like to detract that kind of point to this episode. I think they're being a little bit unfair, but I also understand.
Well, you also have to consider this is like really pre-internet. Like, we don't have the vast knowledge that we have of the internet today. So unless you're going down to a library and looking this stuff up, I could, like, it's probably not well documented stuff at the time, as much as it could have been.
Look, I don't want to spend an entire podcast being defensive about this episode, so let me just sort of get a few things out of the way. Gary Sperling was the story editor of this episode. Adam Jalad wrote it. I'm not sure if it was Adam who did the research or Gary did the research, but I know they did quite a bit of research and on it, some of which we'll talk about later. But, you know, we're under deadline. And Jennifer, you're absolutely right. There was the internet as it is today didn't exist when we were doing this. And so there were limits to what we were able to do in a timely fashion to get it right. So we got it as right as we knew how to get it. I'll also say that at the time, and I'm not throwing, I want to make this very clear, I'm not throwing Michael under the bus, but our sort of unofficial advisor on Native American stuff was Michael Horse, who's the actor who plays Peter Mazza, Elisa's father. Now I would never ask Michael to take that role because he was an actor employed by me. And I can see now, 30 years later, that presents, puts him in an awkward, difficult position where he wants to make sure. And the truth is, if he had told me X, Y, and Z, we would have done that. But from his point of view, I'm his employer. He's worried about be worried about his job. Also, this may not have been a tribe that he was familiar with. So he looked at this stuff and said, yeah, it looks okay to me. But we're talking about the script. And a lot of the issues that people have with this are with some of the visuals. And that we didn't get right. And I'll just cop to that. We didn't get it right. I wish we had. Hindsight being 2020, that's something that if I could redo, I would. But, you know, we did the best we could.
I feel like it did a really good job considering all of that.
I think the story is
yeah,
fairly true to the Haida people because we were able to get books and we read things. The inspiration for this story, quite frankly, comes from, my desire to do this story came from the idea of totem poles and photos of totem poles that I had seen from the American Northwest. And I thought that feels very gargoylian. So Gary and Adam and or Adam did some research and they said, actually, no. The figures on the totem poles represent animal ancestors. It doesn't fit into the, neatly into a gargoyle kind of inspiration. And if we had been, for lack of a better term, less progressive, I would have said, well, screw it. I want to say that it does. But we didn't. That was the research we had. So to the best of our ability, we tried to honor that. We didn't say, screw it, let's just mold that legend to fit our canon and our continuity. We tried to be as true to that as we knew, being lay people and not in those days knowing, and we should have known, but we didn't, it didn't even occur to us to go get an advisor, an independent advisor from the Haida band to advise us. Nowadays, I would do that. If something similar came up on, on Young Justice or something new that I was doing, I would go out of my way to make sure we got advice from the source. But back then, I didn't know to do that. I was a new producer. It was not the 2020s. It was the 1990s. And like I said, I don't want to spend this whole podcast being defensive about it. We did the best job we could at the time. Was it good enough? It really wasn't. But relative to the time, I still think it was progressive. And I think that the story holds up. Not all the visuals hold up, but I think that the story holds up. And we made a real effort. We fell short. Such is life.
True.
Mm-hmm. And hey, now that you've got the comic, if not Solani ever pops up again, well, maybe we can course correct a little
bit. Some of those mistakes. Yeah.
But, I
love the character, Not Solani. I love how he's so reluctant to step into that. Like it's a modern world and he wants to be a modern guy. But there's truth to this magic that is part of his heritage. And I love that part of the story so much.
Yeah, I do too. And, and a lot of that comes, from the writing, but really from Greg Rainwater, who played Not Solani. Greg was someone that Jamie Thomason brought in. I didn't know Greg before that. Now, since then, I've used Greg on nearly every show I've ever done. Because he's just amazing. This was the first time I'd ever used him in a show. And he just, first time out, just knocked it out of the park. Just did terrific work in humanizing this character, making him a hero who doesn't set out to be a hero. Without losing the point of view of Nick as he comes into the episode, he also becomes once again Not Solani. That to me is a real tribute to Greg's work, also because I think the writing's strong, but I think that a lot of that humanity just comes from Greg's performance. And, Jamie contributed to it too, I guess, I always hate to compliment Jamie because, he wants me to.
That's accurate.
Although, if he hears too many compliments from me, he might get a heart attack, so I don't want that either. I don't want that on my conscience.
Just got to have safety.
Yeah.
To contrast what we just discussed prior. Another great point of this episode, the animation and art direction are great. This wasn't Walt Disney Television Animation. It was Sun Min Animation Production. They also did Eye of the Storm. And I thought they did a really good job. It's, the visuals are really good.
It just looks really good. Everybody is like, the gargoyles look great. Elisa looks amazing. I loved the totems coming, the raven turning the totems into, you know, things that it had to battle against. Everything looked really nice.
It's a strong one. It's not one of our stellar ones, like, you know, Future Tense or something like that, but it's definitely on the stronger side, certainly of the ones that were subcontracted out to Korea. This is definitely one of the stronger visual episodes. Thunderbird looks great.
Oh my gosh, the Thunderbird is like amazingly, like
a lot of expression and out of both faces. The sea monster is terrific. And you're right, the gargoyles and Elisa, they're on model and point. And a lot of great expressions for grandmother and Natsalani as well. Some really good stuff there visually. It's interesting. There's a lot of variety to it. Even that last bit at the end where grandmother's hair becomes water and you see the island sort of coming back to life is sort of lovely, I think. And way more effective than it had any right to be given our budgets, you know?
And most of the character acting on Raven, I mean, they got a lot of expression out of a face that had a much less expressive beak than, say, Brooklyn's. And then when he's in his quote-unquote humanoid form after that, there's a lot of the body language there. And I'm going to also talk about the voice actors. There's a line that, you know, I think it was Lawrence Bain who played Raven. He killed it. It's only one episode, but he really killed it. This, the right amount of snark, sarcasm, and there's a moment at the climax where he's about to bring the totem beast to life and he's half-assing the rhyme.
Oh yeah, he just tosses it like da, 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 da. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I've got to go through this. This is how the magic works, but oh, what a pain in the ass. And
like, it's a day at the office. He's just got...
Yeah, you can almost hear him roll his eyes, you know, I mean, which is great. And Lawrence was great in that role, and there's so much, you know, he's got to sound like the tough, grief-stricken gargoyle. He's got to play the trickster. He's got to, you know, he's got to run this gamut of stuff there. So again, a lot of credit to Lawrence and to Jamie. And, you know, there's some sweet stuff there. And tricksters are always fun to write. I mean, Puck, Coyote's coming up, Anansi's coming up. Raven was our second trickster, and it was, and there's a lot of great lying with the truth that Raven does in this episode, which I always enjoy when a character tells the truth, but tells it in such a way that in essence, he's lying to the people that he's talking to. And this also helped us begin to introduce the concept of the Children of Oberon as well.
It did. That's actually one of the points. And we'll talk about that a little bit here, but a little bit later. We'll talk about Oberon and Titania themselves later. But I do know there's been, and it happens also with Odin as well. There's been some controversy about taking all of these, figures from various folklore,
like all the myths, all fall, like all these mythological gods and stuff falling under Children of Oberon umbrella. But it makes them work in the world that we have, that we're working in.
It does. So. And some people might think, and I've actually seen people say this, that this is being Euro or British centric. And I don't think it's that. I think it's just giving Shakespeare priority.
That's really what it comes down to, is that I'm as I think we've established on this podcast, a massive, you know, fanboy for Shakespeare. So I was just giving Shakespeare personally priority as opposed to English culture or Western culture. I was giving just my favorite author priority. But I also, you know, this will come up later, down the road in other episodes, but one thing that was very important to me is that we not depict either Oberon or Titania as white, as Caucasian. So Oberon is blue skin, Titania is green skin. We wanted to set them outside any normal human skin tone so that we weren't showing that, you know, Native American mythology figures and African mythology figures and various monsters and creatures and gods and stuff were all reporting to a white guy. It was important to me that we show that Oberon and Titania were both outside of those considerations. Now, was that enough? I don't know. I mean, it was enough for me. It's still enough for me. Even now, when I'm more woke than I was 30 years ago and consider myself progressive, I still feel like, yeah, I think that does the trick. I could understand that some people wouldn't think that. I understand that point of view. And speaking as a, you know, an old straight male white guy, I can understand why my opinion is suspect. But we made that effort to just not make it be about racial factors by making their skin tones ahuman completely, and taking them out of such considerations, and by choosing two characters from Shakespeare to be the leaders of our third race.
And that's the thing. There's three races. Right. We got your gargoyles, we got your humans, and everything else all over the planet falls under that third one. So,
right,
like
except for dragons.
Well, except for dragons.
Except for motherfucking dragons.
Yes. His first time saying it on the show now. Everyone's going to say it at some point. Every guest from now on, we're going to get every guest to say it at one point. That's the goal.
It's a new jalapeno. All right.
All right. But no, it's a fun episode. And Queen Florence Island, that's a fictional island. Greg,
right.
Why that name in particular?
Well, I think you know the answer, given the way you said it. But I grew up on Queen Florence Lane in Woodland Hills, California. And so there are islands up there, Queen Charlotte Island, and with names like that. And we decided to create a small fictional island, in part, again, because we didn't want to impose what we were about to do on the specific mythology of a specific real world existing island. That seemed, even back then, like, okay, that's obnoxious. So we chose to create a fictional island, but since the islands had names like Queen Charlotte, I said, well, let's call this one Queen Florence, because that was the street I lived on when I was a little kid. and I imagine I lived on Queen Florence Lane, and the cross street was Queen Victoria Road. So I imagine that right next to Queen Florence Island, there's also a Queen Victoria Island. And then there's some distance away is Queen Charlotte Island, which is real. So, you know, that's a little fun Easter egg for my brother and sister and me and no one else.
And no one else.
You're allowed. You're the author.
So we threw that in there. But the reason we didn't, that's why that name was chosen. But the reason that we had to choose a name was because we thought, okay, we don't want to be imposing this story on a real world island. That seemed obnoxious. So let's create a fictional location. And we did that all the time. We, you know, and the world tour really shows that, you know, sometimes we use real world places like Paris or Prague, just like we used Manhattan, but sometimes it seemed better, more appropriate to create a fictional location like Ishimura, Japan, or Chaquichel in Guatemala, or in this case, Queen Florence Island. The names, how we get develop the names, there's always some story attached to that. But the why we choose it was usually about actually trying to be respectful. You know, if you're doing the gargoyles on Notre Dame Cathedral, obviously you're going to set that in Paris. But to do a story like this, we felt like we needed to create a fictional location in order for it to, in essence, play fair with local mythologies.
Yeah, that makes sense. But this is a fun episode. When the episode, personal level, when the episode opens, I like that Elisa, we'll talk about this more when we get to Gollum, of course, but they're still focused more on getting home. They don't seem to realize this is a quest yet. And when she's talking how the first thing she's going to do when she gets back is get a hot dog from the local vendor. And when I was at this place in New York, or when I was spent a year in Florida or a couple of years in California, anytime I came back, it wasn't a hot dog for me. It was pizza at John's on Bleecker Street. First thing I would always want to do. So I really felt her there. I'm like, yeah, we have a lot of great
food. You have the one food thing that you associate with that place that.
Yes.
Looking forward to.
Mm-hmm. Pizza.
I mean, to me, Elisa, one of the things about Elisa is that, you know, she's biracial. She's got a lot of influences, but first and foremost, and this is in the Bible for the show, Elisa Mazza is a New Yorker, born and raised in New York City. And that is home. And so often wherever she goes, she's either thinking of home or viewing the place relative to home. So like she's walking through the forest on Queen Florence Island and she's going, it's not exactly Central Park. You know, I mean, New York is always on Elisa's mind. And I think, you know, that's one of the hallmarks of her character that, you know, that's a fundamental piece of who she is New York City.
And let me tell you something, and I speak from experience, it's maybe one of our shortcomings, but yeah, that's a New Yorker. I speak as one, yeah, always. We compare everything. And I apologize when we get obnoxious about it. Well, and there's also, I think, a very strong Angela episode. She's the one who figures out what's going on. I mean, she's presented as naive, but she's also very clever. She sees through Raven's ruse, and I think she was suspicious of him long before Goliath was, even before that.
Well, I think he was feeding into Goliath, like, more. Like, I, you know, I don't know why she was less trusting in regards to this, but I think Goliath was just falling for it harder.
Yeah, I think for Goliath, you have to remember he's coming out of shadows of the past. So ideas of humans being complicated messes who betray us all the time and make our lives miserable, and yet we still strive to protect because that's who we are. To me, that's all those things are part of Goliath, but they've just been strongly reinforced by Shadows of the Past because he was just back in Wyvern, right? On the other hand, for Angela, you know, she's often been described as naive, but that's just naive to the ways of the outside world. It's not like she's, you know, a naive individual. And certainly she's not dumb. She's smart. She's the daughter of Goliath and Damona. And Damona is not stupid. you know, she's many things, but unintelligent is not one of them. And that's true for Angela as well. So there are things that just aren't ringing true for her in what Raven is saying to Goliath. And Goliath is sort of accepting them because I agree with you, Jennifer. Raven is feeding right into Goliath's fears and resentments and all this sort of thing. Angela doesn't have those, not on these subjects anyway. And so... like, wait a minute, you're trying to tell me that 2 + 3 = 4, and that's not true. How does this fit together? You know, the puzzle pieces aren't working. And then, of course, she notices the illusion when the Thunderbird's wing just passes right through one of the faux gargoyles that Raven has created as an illusion. And so she spots that and then is smart enough not to tip her hand right away.
And like confident enough to shut down Goliath and override what he was going to say. So like, I really like her in this episode a lot.
Me too. And Raven's not just playing into Goliath's fears and anxieties and prejudices. He's playing into his hopes as well. He wants to find other gargoyles out there, and Raven just dangles that in front of him. So I love when Goliath blows up at him at the end, perfectly willing to fight him with or without not Solani. He's just, the guy ticked him off.
Yeah. And that's not a bright thing to do with Goliath, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Goliath is not, you know, he's a pretty reasonable guy, so it can be tough to anger him. But when you do, watch out. And yet one thing that I saw that, and God knows I've seen this episode many times, though not recently, but one thing I noticed last night that I'd sort of forgotten about is Goliath actually plays dead for a bear goyle, you know? And I'm like, that's sort of clever. It's clever on two levels. It's sort of clever on the meta level. Oh, if you see a bear, play dead. I don't even know if that's good advice, but that was always the cliche, that if you see a bear, play dead, and Goliath does, only it's not a bear, it's a bear goyle. And hey, that's not, you know, Goliath is not big in a battle on subterfuge, generally speaking. He's, he tends to be pretty direct, punching and clawing things and that sort of deal. Which is not to say he's dumb in a fight. I think he's smart in a fight, but he is straightforward, you know. He'll jump on a robot, you know, force it to fly upward so it crashes into another, you know, in other words, he understands aerodynamics. He has a natural understanding of that kind of thing, fighting tactics. He's good at this stuff. But one thing that we don't see him do very often is fake out moments like this. You know, it's almost like when he pops up to smash that wooden construct, the bear goyle, you almost feel like he's about to say psych. You know, I mean, he wouldn't, because that's not Goliath, but still, I was just like, wow, that was an unusual moment for him. So that was kind of fun, I thought, during that fight. And then it also just becomes clear, I guess, if you're gonna fight gargoyles, throwing wood creatures against them, maybe not quite tough enough.
Yeah, like it should have been like in the manual, like you might want to try something that can't leave claw marks in solid stone.
Right, exactly.
I love that there were two sets of designs for them, ones that looked like flesh and blood gargoyles and ones that were just wood. I mean, that
the
was
totems,
the totems. That was the extra mile. You didn't have to go there, and you did, which you often did on the show. That it's one of the reasons why we remember to this day, just those little extra touches. I love that.
Yeah, again, that I'm sure was Frank. My guess is that, I mean, I don't remember for 100% sure, but my guess is that when we wrote that, we assumed that the totem gargoyles and the illusion gargoyles would be the same models, because otherwise you're doubling the model count on those characters, and you got to do it in color. And then, you know, they have the volcano colors as well. By the way, the lighting in
that was a great scene.
Super cool. Super cool. But that, all that,
so cool,
that really goes to Frank, you know, for just deciding I want to go to town here a little bit with this stuff. And there's one beat in there that tiny beat. At the end, when Raven flies away, he's flying away in his Raven Goyle form, and that was a mistake. He was supposed to fly away as just the bird Raven. And I do think still that would have been better. But it came back from overseas. They had misunderstood, and they they used the Raven Goyle form. Again, I don't remember specifically, but my guess is that we just didn't have the time to have them completely reanimate. You know, in other words, it's one thing to call a retake when you're saying, hey, his character's a little off model, you need to fix that, it's an adjustment. But to, in essence, switch out an entirely different model that's also entirely on a different scale, a little bird as opposed to a big gargoyle, that's a lot more work and obviously a lot more time. And my guess is we just didn't have the time for that. Either that or someone talked me out of getting what I wanted, which was frankly rare, but happened occasionally. But it still bugs me 30 years later. but otherwise, you know, I love that sea monster. I don't think I'd seen it back then, so I wonder if, but I've since seen like a National Geographic or some, you know, Nova or Nature, I can't remember now, but some sort of PBS special that sort of posited what prehistoric whales look like. And I was like really knocked out how much it looked like our model on the sea monster here, that like, oh, that might be more accurate than we thought it, than we even knew it was.
Well, the legend of Natsalani, like he creates orcas. He like uses magic and creates orcas. He's like one of the best hunters in the Pacific Northwest, and his three brother-in-laws try to conspire to kill him, and he carves the blackfish, and blackfish attacks the three brothers and then makes a pact to never attack humans again. So that's all part of the Natsalani thing. And so the sea monster is like beautiful in that whole bit of lore as well.
Yeah.
Awesome. I didn't actually know any of that until you educated me about this a few days ago. So thank you. I mean, that's I've got a blind spot here.
It's a really cool, like go check out the lore on that one, because that's it's just an interesting and kind of unique corner of the world where you get some really epic mythology, and it's really cool.
Oh, I'm definitely going to. And back to the subject of Goliath, he talks about the Goliath credo, the gargoyle credo with Angela, but I love how its prejudices seep in there. I'm not saying I love prejudice, but I love as a character and a hero, he's allowed to have them, because we talked about this a little bit with last time with Still, I Wanted Revenge. You allow him to have these aspects of him, which most TV shows would shy away from. I mean, I know people who will sometimes freak out anytime a main character exhibits any kind of negative personality trait.
Yeah, I mean, to me, a character, not just Goliath, but obviously including Goliath, is more of a hero if they have negative impulses that they don't follow up on. You know, yeah. I mean, there are so many people.
Like, it's there, they're not shiny and perfect. They could go that other way, but they choose not to.
Right, exactly. And, you know, there are people in public life these days that I wish would just stop acting on their more negative impulses, let alone saying them out loud all the time, every fucking time they open their mouths. But that's a whole other story. But I do, you know, I don't get the notion of, oh, every character has to not just do right, but speak right and think right all the time. It's like, who's like that? No one I know never has a negative thought. We all have horrible thoughts here and there. And, you know, the trick is to not let them infect the world. You know, and how one deals with that, whether it's, you know, therapy or friends or whatever, or just self-realization. I don't, you know, there are all sorts of solutions there. But to me, again, that makes him more of a hero. If he never has a negative thought, then, well, I guess being a hero is easy, you know.
Right.
Because, you know, you never, you know, I think a good example of that is Buzz Lightyear in the very first Toy Story movie. for most of that movie, Buzz literally doesn't ever have a negative thought. And so it's easy for him to be a hero. And then in the last, I don't know, third of the movie, let's say, suddenly his eyes have been opened.
Post and he's Mrs. got all Nesbitt. Sorts of
He's got all sorts of negative thoughts, and still he overcomes them to do the right thing. And that when he truly becomes a hero, because before that it was easy. He would stumble into heroic stuff because he never thought otherwise. But once you become human, you know, a real boy, so to speak, it's a lot harder. And so if you still do the right thing, despite your negative impulses, that makes you more of a hero, not less of a hero. So I've never really understood that argument that, oh, you can't let him say that. You can't let him think that. It's like, yeah, I can. Why not? And so, you know, it's more fun that way also.
We haven't yet mentioned Amantha Damali. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, as grandmother. I thought she did a great job with this in this one episode she did.
Yeah, it's Amantha Damali.
Amantha Damali. Thank you, Amantha Damali. And a memorable character. And I just love how she's she's sort of... I like how she's that mentor figure to the reluctant hero. It's something we've seen a lot, but it feels a little bit unique here. As well, Nick is a flawed hero. He eventually comes around, of course, and while she's healing Elisa with roots and all sorts of ancient remedies. Of course, I'm also going to say in real life, if you're sick, go to a doctor. But
yeah, she's great as a grandmother, and grandmother's an interesting character. You know, she's got rules that she needs to follow. And that that means that there are certain limitations that she approaches Natsalani. And she tries to work within those limitations, and it doesn't work out too well, particularly because there was no way for her to predict the gargoyles completely messing up. And yet in the end, it all works out okay. It's fun. It's a fun character.
Another fun moment, just nothing too deep, but Bronx tackles a grizzly bear. And then he pokes his head out in an adorable scene. And speaking of adorable, how about that hug between our two heroes?
Yeah. No, that's... There's a few touching moments in the whole thing, and a few squeal moments for us little fans, like as well. But I would love to have a cell of Bronx poking his head out of that bush after he attacks the bear.
That's the cutest he has ever been.
He is cute every day.
He's the goodest.
I felt bad for the bear. Bear's minding its own business. Raven comes in and startles him, and it's sort of like, hey, what did the bear do? Adorable. And I love that hug too. And what's interesting to me is, given where we are in Goliath and Elisa's courtship, that's a very unselfconscious hug. Like, they're so relieved to see each other that they embrace in a way that you don't usually see them do at this stage in the show. Because, you know, each was terrified that something had happened to the other. And so there, it's just relief that's sort of breaking down walls that Elise in particular, generally speaking, kept between them to avoid getting too close. So it's sort of nice to
Such a sweet hug.
Yeah.
It was, yeah. And I just, again, I keep talking about the design work. I love the look of the island, both designs. the island teeming with life and also desolate. And I know you've got big plans for this island. It was a centerpiece of the 2198 pitch that you posted over 20 years ago now. Dynamite, please make that series happen. And, you know, this is a lot of other lovely moments throughout this episode. Lisa quotes Shakespeare. There are more things in heaven and earth, not Salami, that are dreamed up in your philosophy.
Substituted the word Nazzolani for Horatio. Again, big Shakespeare fanboy. So that was an obvious choice for me.
We are going to point out all of these every single time it happens. Every Shakespearean reference, we're going to point
them out. I like when she tells him to get some new ways or some old ways.
Yeah. I mean, they had some good chemistry, actually, between them, Elisa and Nazzolani, I thought. Maybe not relative to Goliath, but relative to a lot of people, I thought they had a nice little thing going there.
Well, add him to the possible list. If she had never met Goliath and he'd had more time, maybe, just like if she had never met Goliath and Jason Canmore, who we'll talk about later, didn't turn out to be a hunter.
Well,
hunter, I mean, you can see it. There's definite chemistry between those two, and Sally and Greg Rainwater really played off of each other well. I mean, I know this is Greg's first of two episodes, but he felt like he had been there all along. He just slipped right into this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I do enjoy the fight scene at the end on top of the volcano, costuming aside, although I am kind of curious. Again, I'm ignorant of a lot of this lore, and I'm going to do some research. What was Nazzolani? That was a magic staff of some kind. I'm sure it's got to be more of a story behind the weapon that he was using.
I don't remember now. I'm sure we had a reason for choosing what we chose. Again, within the limited scope of no internet and minimal time, we tried to get it right. I can't remember now whether we got it right or not. I can't remember whether where it came from, but all the choices were made with intention to the best of our knowledge at that moment in time.
Nothing was frivolous.
Never was. Not on this show.
Goliath just has this one great line that I just want to call out because Keith read it so well. I don't know who the line came from, whether it was Adam or Gary or me, but Goliath has this great line where we live, but we do not thrive, which I just, the way he reads that is just so laced with passion and bitterness and it's just, you know, this terrific Keith David Reed on a terrific gargoyle line, Goliath line. And so I just wanted to call out that one line because I love it so much. Lawrence has some great lines too. Like we talked about the rhyme earlier, but I love at the end when he's sort of beaten, he goes, "This place no longer amuses me," and takes off.
Who are you guys? I'm going home.
Yeah. So that was fun. And you know, the idea that, so it's done now, right? And grandmother's like, no, it's done for now, but this is an ongoing thing. That's why, you know, your people need to know their stories. And I think, you know, if nothing else, that was one of the lessons, themes of the episode is, you know your stories, value them, and precious, you know, they're precious. And I think that's true, even if there is no real magic in the world, that it's still really important to know your stories, you know? And so I think that lesson applies, you know, it's easy to apply it in a world with magic where the story literally might pay off in saving your island and that kind of thing. But I think it's an important lesson, even in a world where magic is less obvious than in the Gargoyle universe. And so that to me was sort of a big thematic piece of the episode as a whole. And, you know, we have later episodes, including the next one where, you know, monster attacks the boat, skiff turns over. We'll get to that.
That's two episodes.
And we've got Cloud. Two episodes. Then we have Cloud Fathers, which deals with some of the same themes of as well. But as I've said before, we always just chose the best stories we had in our arsenal. And the idea of doing a story that was inspired by totem poles, that was important to me. And so I'm glad we did it. It's flawed, but I'm still really pretty proud of it and happy with it. It's not perfect, but I like it. And there's a lot of great stuff in it. That's probably all I've got.
Well, the most flawed episodes of Gargoyles rate would be graded, say, a B, then it was a pretty damn fantastic show. So, I mean, and I'll admit, personally, this is not one of my favorites. If I had to rank them, and I don't like to do that, it would probably be closer to the bottom, but I still enjoy it a lot. So there isn't an episode of the series I dislike. I mean, every episode was either great to good. And how many shows can say that? And especially with an episode count like 65.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with 52 of them done in a really short period of time. Yeah,
seriously cranked out.
Yeah. I mean, the first season, when we were making the first season, we didn't feel like, this is easy. Look how much time we have. But if you compare that to the second season, we look back at the first season, you know, like, oh my God, look how much time we had. Because now we have no time. We're on this freight train. It never stops. So, like I said, you know, we were very conscientious. We did the best we could. You can see in this episode, Frank in particular really went the extra mile with the volcano and the lighting and the multiple models and all this sort of stuff. We never just hacked it out, but you know, some turned out better than others, and that's, you know, that's the biz.
It do be that way sometimes.
Mm-hmm. All right, does anyone else have anything else they want to say about this particular episode?
Nope. I'm good.
I'm good also. All right, so let's plug some projects. This is coming out on March 29th.
So if this is March, end of March, by now, you should have all six issues of Gargoyles Dark Ages. Issue six for us when we're recording this just came out. And that brings that miniseries to an end. You should have all 12 issues of the main Gargoyles title. That brings the Here in Manhattan arc to an end. And you should also have the first issue of The Spectacular Spider-Men, which came out for us last week. I'm pretty proud of all three of those issues. Dark Ages 6, Gargoyles 12, and Spec Spider-Men 1. So I hope people go pick them up, check them out. Pre-order what's coming next. We've got Gargoyles Quest launching next month, April, issue one, and Spectacular Spider-Man is ongoing. I even wrote a little story for Web of Spider-Man, which is coming out soon. And then the big thing that I've been pushing and I continue to push is the 30th anniversary celebration for Gargoyles, which was taking place at Convergence in Minneapolis over the 4th of July weekend. Greg will be there. Jennifer will be there. I will be there. Tom Adcox, voice of Lexington, will be there. Zara Fuzzle, voice of Sherry, will be there. Keith David, voice of Goliath, will be there. And more. that we're so close to being able to announce, but I can't announce just yet, but soon. And nice. So if you are a new Gargoyle fan, an old Gargoyle fan, we've got, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in that convention that has nothing to do with Gargoyles. And we'll also be doing panels for Young Justice and Spectacular Spider-Man, the TV show, and Spectacular Spider-Man, the comic book. But we are going to do a bunch of Gargoyles things. We're doing a radio play. We're doing a live broadcast of this podcast there. And we've even got a pie contest. So you just don't want to miss this convention. If there's any chance of you making it, you should really go for it. Again, 4th of July weekend, Minneapolis, just check the internet, just look up Convergence 2024 and check it out.
And thank you both for everything you do, Greg. Thank you for everything you do, Jennifer. I know I say this every time. Thank you for everything you do for this show. Again, couldn't do it without you. And to our listeners, thank you for listening. And join us next time when we briefly return to Manhattan for Kingdom, a really great Brooklyn episode.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Voices from the Eerie, a Gargoyles podcast, powered by the Spidey Dude Radio Network, located at spidey-dude.com. If you like this show, then please listen to Spectacular Radio, based on the Spectacular Spider-Man animated series, which features some familiar voices. You can also find these great podcasts, Clone Saga Chronicles, Make Mine Mayday, Amazing Spider-Man Classics, the Sal Buscema Podcast, and Books of X. All of this and more on the Spidey Dude Radio Network. And please follow us on Twitter at From Eerie. That's From EYRIE. And join us on Patreon at patreon.com/SpideyDudeNetwork for more exclusive content. Thank you.
Totem beasts entrapped in wood, the time has come to do some good.